Joel Brandenberger, and I'm the president of the National Turkey Federation.
All right, Joel. Recently, Consumer Reports magazine came out with a study on ground turkey and had some results that your organization is strongly disputing. Tell us what they said and what you have to say about what they said.
Well, it's really a shame because Consumer Reports has a certain reputation, and because it had the opportunity to foster a really thoughtful and sober debate on food safety, on animal production practices. And instead, we saw something sensationalized that will certainly sell magazines, certainly get media attention, but sadly is really misleading to their readers and everybody who's heard about the report. What they have said is that a significant amount of turkey is, quote, contaminated with bacteria, and they have said that that bacteria is allegedly antibiotic resistant. What they're not telling their readers is that the overwhelming majority of the bacteria they're talking about do not present safety hazards, and that most of the antibiotics in question either are not used on the farm or are not used in human medicine. So, you know, in reality, if you break this down, you know, if they were really honestly and objectively reporting it, they would focus on the fact that the two pathogens they tested for that have the greatest public health concern, Salmonella, Campylobacter, they found almost none on the turkeys. In reality, what they found was very encouraging. It was good news to a large extent, but of course it wasn't reported that way.
Okay. Break it down for the consumer. I'm a consumer. Tell me what I need to know if I hear this story, and I'm going to, you have just said, explained that there was some good news in this study. Address what they found in terms of they had a generic E. coli finding, I believe, and a couple of other things. Tell me why I don't have to worry about that.
Okay. Two reasons. And the first reason, and I want to emphasize this, as the consumer, you have final control over the safety of the food in your hand. You know, our industry, all food producers can invest millions and millions, literally collectively billions of dollars to ensure food safety. And the good news is, even after all that's done, you as a consumer hold the final power in your hands. If you cook turkey to 165 degrees, if you cook all meat and poultry, all foods to its proper doneness, you will kill anything in there, any bacteria that might be harmful. If you take care to wash your hands after handling raw meat or poultry, if you make sure you wash your utensils and your surfaces that come in contact with raw meat and poultry, if you make sure that you use a different plate to take the food off the grill or out of the oven than you used to handle it when it was raw, you're not, you know, you're perfectly safe. You're going to be completely safe. That's the first reason there should, you know, the consumers should feel that there's good news. I can actually give you a total of three reasons. Second reason is the Consumer Reports tests, and they would never report it this way, sadly, found that what our industry has done to address the two most significant foodborne illness threats associated with poultry, our industry's been wildly successful. You know, we're controlling it to a greater degree than ever before, and Consumer Reports tests prove that. The third reason is the bacteria that they chose to use headlines, Enterococcus, generic E. coli, they're not threats at all. And if you'd like, I can elaborate on that point.
Yes, please do. Please do.
Okay. Two main flaws with the magazine's article. One, they don't tell you is that Enterococcus and generic E. coli is everywhere. It's not just something that might be found on food. It's on you. It's on me. Studies have shown that generic E. coli is on about 20% to 30% of our cell phones. That's how common it is in the environment. If you were to swab your skin or mine, you'd probably find one or both of that bacteria there. And that goes to the second point. They hinted in the article that there was only one possible way that that bacteria, you know, could be on food, on poultry, on turkey. And in reality, as you see from what I just told you, there are thousands of routes on, that bacteria can show up on any surface of any kind. So, that part of the report was just extremely misleading, and that was really what was disheartening.
Now, when I hear the word as a consumer, E. coli, I kind of panic because I know how dangerous that can be. So when I hear you tell me, the consumer, that something called E. coli, generic or not, why are you telling me that that's okay and I'm not going to get sick from that?
Okay. When it comes to E. coli, there are two different types. There are specific E. coli strains, like the one most people have heard of, 0157H7. There's a total of about six strains that have been known to cause illness. Those are six out of millions of E. coli strains. The rest, the generic E. coli, that's not one of these six or so strains, it can be used as an indicator of a number of things, but it is not in and of itself a foodborne illness threat. It's not a threat to your health.
What do you mean an indicator of other things? Define that.
Well, what you could do they're called indicator organisms because when you're looking to try to understand how process control is working, it's one you could choose to look at. Wisely, the government has chosen to look at Salmonella. It's the prime indicator organism because it's the main. It is one of the main, food safety threats associated with meat and poultry. And if you look at the Salmonella tests, the government conducts thousands of Salmonella tests each month on turkey products. You know, we have gotten to a point where this naturally occurring organism is showing up in only slightly more than 10% of ground turkey out there. Consumer Reports findings were even lower, and showing up in less than 3% of whole turkeys. That's a phenomenal job of controlling, a naturally occurring organism that does represent a food safety threat. And if you continue to do things like you helped us do this morning to educate the consumers about proper food handling, you've really virtually eliminated a threat.
The cooking, back to what you were saying, if proper food handling, if worst case scenario in the consumer's mind that does have a dangerous E. coli strain, if they cook that turkey properly, will they be protected?
Yes. I mean, going back, let me say something.
No, you're doing a great job.
No, that's fine. The E. coli strains that I mentioned are not a threat on poultry. They've showed up in other products. But even with those, cooked to proper doneness, you can kill the organism. Consumers really do have control.
Okay, but I'm also, I'm taking it as far as I can here, even the dangerous strains.
Sure.
That's what I want to know about the really dangerous ones, like 0150.
Oh, no, that's what I'm sorry, I probably wasn't clear. Those were what I was talking about.
Okay, really, I thought you were talking about the generic. Okay, gotcha.
No. The really dangerous strains of E. coli have not turned up in poultry, but consumers of other meat products, if they cook their products properly, even the most dangerous strains of E. coli are killed.
Okay. Dangers, though, are everywhere if the handling is improper, if the hands aren't washed, if the hands touch something else, if that raw meat surface, some other food comes in contact with. That's where the careful kitchen habits need to come into play, right?
No, that's exactly right. And as I was saying to someone, recently, what's basically happening out there is we're having to relearn what all of our grandmothers knew. As we've gotten, as a society, further removed from the farm, further removed from food production, it's easy for people to forget that these aren't sterile creatures. They can't possibly be sterile creatures. Like every living creature, they have bacteria. And, the industry spends millions and millions of dollars to control that bacteria, but consumers have a part to play in that as well. And it's something, something literally my grandmother never thought twice about. She knew you had to do this. we just unfortunately have a generation or two that we need to re-educate.
That's exactly right. You hit the nail on the head with that. Joel, let me ask you, let's talk about the benefits of eating ground turkey as a product. if someone were to say, well, I'm not going to touch ground turkey ever again, what would they be missing out on in their diet?
Well, they would be missing out probably on one of the most versatile products you can find in the supermarket. It is adaptable to so many recipes, and it has an outstanding nutritional profile. The most common form of ground turkey that's purchased in the supermarket, and you see it in tray packs where you are, is what they call the 93-7 blend of ground turkey. It means it's 93% lean. You know, it's hard to find, you know, ground products from other areas that have a comparable nutritional profile and that are that versatile. You know, obviously people can make turkey burgers with it. That's probably what I use it for most myself. But I'm a Texan. I use it for taco meat too, and for chili. And my wife's Italian. She uses it in pasta recipes. It is that adaptable. And trust me, you know, there's not that much that fans of Italian food and Tex-Mex can agree on. So it is completely versatile. Restaurant near my house serves a fantastic turkey meatloaf and a wild mushroom gravy. It's honestly, it's that adaptable. I don't know of many things out there that are that versatile and that healthy.
Well, Joel, you mentioned that it is lean and it's versatile. What are some of the nutrients that are extremely important in that we get from ground turkey?
Well, turkey is what they call a very nutrient-dense protein, and in that extent, you get incredible bang for your buck. It is a very high-protein product, and a lot of people are looking at high-protein, low-carb diets, and this is a really affordable option that you can use in those products. So, extremely high in protein. And if you really want to cut out the fat, there's what's called a 99-1 blend out there made from ground turkey breast that has only 1% fat. And literally, you cannot find that in any other kind of ground product anywhere. And again, extremely affordable, protein rich. It's a really, really terrific option.
Okay, let's talk a little bit from the industry side. I'm a turkey producer, and how are sales going for turkey, ground turkey products in particular, but turkey in general as well?
Ground turkey is really one of our main growth products. It's probably now somewhere between 15 and 20% of total purchases of turkey products out there. You know, the deli meats are still number one, and obviously whole birds during the holiday season. But ground turkey is rising fast. The industry produced probably a little more than 600 million pounds of last year, most of which was sold domestically. And so it really is one of our growth opportunities. You've seen Burger King has introduced a turkey burger in recent weeks. And in fact, I went to Burger King the other night, tried to order one. They said they were out. I thought, they're just not ordering it in. But someone else in another part of the country talked to the manager at the Burger King, said, no, the problem is we can't keep them in stock. They're selling that fast. So that's a really positive development for the industry. Overall, turkey consumption, in this country per capita has remained steady at about 16.5 pounds or so per person, and that's been pretty steady for the last decade or more. What has changed are the type of turkey products that are consumed. Consumers are switching, less whole birds. It's still a big seller at the holidays, but whole birds used to be half of all turkey consumption. Now it's about a third of all turkey consumption. And so they're switching to, you go to the store, you can see some companies have this product they call a turkey chop or a turkey steak, which is a great breast meat product that you can cook like you would a pork chop, or if it's a little thicker, like a steak. Others have, turkey tenderloins are becoming really popular. You can find both marinated, you can find that in a lot of stores. Some stores sell it, just plain, unmarinated, so you can season it how you'd like. So tenderloins are becoming very popular. Obviously, we've talked about ground turkey. Turkey, you know, if you want to talk about ready-to-cook products, turkey bacon has been a big seller. Turkey sausage is growing. You've got in most supermarkets now, you can find an option. We've got one member that offers great raw, you know, ready-to-cook-yourself turkey sausage links. We've got other member that offers pre-cooked, ready-to-warm-up sausage links and, you know, turkey sausage links and turkey sausage patties. Had a member just introduced a maple turkey sausage patty. It's incredible. So that's really what's happening. You know, overall consumption pretty flat, but a move to some of the you know, the more value-added higher-end products. That seems to be what customers are shifting to.
On the production side, the biggest challenge is high feed costs.
High feed costs are absolutely the biggest challenge. You know, we've got to find a way to get a handle on the volatility in feed costs. And we're very hopeful we can find a way that, you know, that to do this, that keeps, you know, because the biggest problem is corn volatility. We've had a lot of corn shift from animal feed to ethanol production. And when corn crops are growing rapidly, it's been hard, but you've been able to manage it a little bit. But we saw last year the danger when you have a subpar crop, when you have a drought, the feed cost problem becomes acute. I'm hoping that we can find a way. You know, I know Congress is looking at it. We're working hard on it, that we can find a way to balance out the needs of all corn consumers and get a little bit of this volatility out of the market.
And how does your organization support doing that?
Well, I think if you've seen even in some of the comments of the ethanol industry, it has matured to the point where its product's going to be in demand no matter what the federal government does. You know, it's a great oxygenating agent in gasoline. You talk to oil refiners, you know they're going to use ethanol to oxygenate, especially in highly populated areas that, you know, where the requirements are for oxygenated gasoline. It also adds octane to gasoline. A lot of refiners will tell you, since the law requires them to blend ethanol anyway, they're refining petroleum to 84 octane and using ethanol to make up the difference. And when ethanol is priced lower than oil or gasoline, you know, that's a deal. So the industry has matured considerably. It now has a customer base in the petroleum refiners that it's probably not going to lose. You know, maybe in a free market they wouldn't buy quite as much as they do now, but it's a market that's never going to go away. It's matured. It's in a solid position. The core point is this. The ethanol industry has matured to the point where it has a customer base that isn't going to go away. You know, without government mandates, might their customers buy a little less than they do now? That's possible. But, you know, I think the ethanol industry can feel really, really comfortable that they've got a market that's here to stay. So the trick in our mind is, how do you smoothly transition from a government-driven ethanol market to a, you know, customer-driven ethanol market? And no one has found the exact right formula yet, and obviously there have been a lot of contentious discussions, but I guess I'm an optimist. I believe that Congress, the administration, the ethanol industry, other corn consumers will ultimately come together on a plan that allows that transition to happen.
All right. Some are calling for, in the livestock industry, are calling for, you know, getting rid of the RFS, basically.
Well, I think, you know, I personally, we believe you could get rid of the RFS for corn-based ethanol tomorrow, and you would not see, you know, a dramatic change in what the refiners do, you know, how they consume corn-based ethanol to blend in their gasoline. So refiners said as much last fall, and the ethanol industry said as much last fall when there was a request for a waiver of the RFS, which we did support. You know, I'll be open about that. And we believe that, you know, and frankly, you know, we support some of the legislation that's out there. We understand that it's a starting point for discussions. And, you know, like I said, I'm an optimist. I really remain hopeful that everybody will get to a point where we can sit down and find a way to make this transition.
Okay. Well, anything else you'd to add? We certainly covered, you answered every one of my questions, I think, that have to do with the turkey industry. So I really appreciate that. And is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I I'd like to make an observation. You know, the biggest challenge I think we have when something comes out there is what I talked about. You know, we're several generations removed from the majority of Americans understanding what it takes to produce food and get it on their table. Americans don't understand, you don't, a lot of Americans don't appreciate the challenge, and it's understandable. They're not near the farm. But you think about the world population is going to grow to about 9 billion people. These people will live longer. By 2050, we're going to probably need to double the amount of food we produce in the world. You know, it's going to take, you know, making a lot of smart choices about how we produce food to make sure we can feed all these people. And I think it's sort of incumbent on all of us who are involved in food production to talk to our friends, talk to our family that are outside of food production. Always take a moment, every opportunity you've got, to sort of help them understand what it's taking to produce food and how to separate the reality of it from the sensational. It's important. You all are doing that job. Y'all, your listeners are the key ingredient in doing that job. So, it's a challenge. We know it's a challenge, but it's one we welcome. We think we can get there.